We've all heard the phrase, that kind of thing doesn't happen in our town. But here on Midwest Murder, we will shatter that false reality. In fact, it happens more often than we know. And sometimes the details of the most horrific crimes that happen in our neighborhoods are lost in the back pages of newspapers, forgotten on our news channels, and eventually erased over time. We're here to talk about murder, diving into some of the most controversial cases in Midwest history. This show will not shy away from the morbid details of these horrific events and the often ugly truths behind them. What you will hear is a detailed timeline of events, perspectives from those closely involved, and analysis by experts. What you will feel is the darkness that surrounds each story, the innocence lost by the victims, and hopefully the justice that was ultimately delivered.
Jonah Lanto.
Don Palumbo.
Hi. Hi.
Here we are in Fargo, and I gotta say, these folks have really shown out for us over the years, and we appreciate all of you so very much for sharing an evening with us, getting babysitters, making plans, doing it. We really do appreciate that deeply. And a big thanks as well to the team at Jade Presents and all the work they do to make sure these shows are a success. We can't thank them enough. And last, and certainly not least, we appreciate our listeners. Without you, we wouldn't be here. So thanks for taking us with you on road trips, workouts, yard work, house cleaning, bedtime. Surprisingly, a lot of people use us as a sleep mechanism.
You would think with...
And they don't mean that as an insult. Not like you put me to sleep,
like,
but...
You boring assholes.
So wherever you're listening, we thank you. And a big shout out tonight to Bennett Creative Media.
Oh, yeah.
He's filming this show for
us. Cheers to Easton.
And I got to tell you, Bennett Creative Media, if you are in the neighborhood market for commercial or creative video production, he is one of the best in the state. So
1,000%,
thanks, Easton, for being here.
Yeah.
That is amazing. But Don, I also want to thank everybody who takes a little bit of time out of their busy life to review us on iTunes, Facebook, Spotify, Audible, and Amazon. I'm curious, what are people saying about us in the review columns these days?
It's a huge deal. When Terry was talking about us, you know, being on the globally trending charts and the, you know, the US charts, all of that, that is because you guys rate and review us. And that is, it does amazing things for us. And thank you. Leaving was almost lethal, almost in capital letters, 5 stars. 5 stars all around. This is a lengthy one, too.
From Swim Mom 2002.
Oh, from Swim Mom 2002. Hey, 2002, that's... Go Magi. 5 stars all around. I am a special education teacher by day and school janitor by night. So I binged Midwest Murder in the evenings until I had listened to every episode. I come from a small town in Illinois where, quote, that kind of thing doesn't happen. And I'm here to say that it very much does happen. Unfortunately, so many incidents get covered up, overlooked, or downright ignored when reported. The episode, Leaving Was Lethal, resonates with me, and my heart aches for the victim and family. My own life turned upside down a few years ago when my ex-husband became possessive and abusive after 15 years of marriage. I faced a year of every imaginable type of abuse, torment, threats, stalking, and was even held hostage at gunpoint for 3 hours.
The story hasn't started yet. This is
a
review.
This is
a chilling.
Review. While my case did not end in tragedy, my voice was never heard. Oh, I'm so sorry for that. The police failed me miserably and left me to live in fear daily, constantly watching over my shoulder and shuddering at every sound. Why are you going to go ahead and pick this one? This one is going to make me emotional. Don,
it's going to be an emotional night.
Thank you for talking about how it is not just that easy to leave and to not ask people, why didn't you leave sooner? Victims cannot reasonably answer that question and should not be expected to. I came here to say thank you both for sharing these stories and bringing the voices of the victims back to life. You were in so much trouble even after that cake. I don't like getting emotional in public. Your work is important and you are a perfect balance of Jonah-splaining, intellectually lazy conversation, and witty banter. Despite my negative experience with law enforcement, a huge debt of gratitude to the men and women who work countless hours protecting victims and families while bringing the assailants to justice. Your dedication and perseverance does not go unnoticed. Keep fighting the good fight because their voices all deserve to be heard. Thank you. That's really cool.
We got Don crying before the story even started.
That is, dang.
Usually I'm the crier.
He is, yeah. From Facebook, Carrie Lewis recommended us. Literally binged and finished them in a little over 2 weeks. Great show. Makes me laugh way too much.
I balanced the long one with the really short one for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
Thanks.
Thank you guys. We appreciate that. And thank you both for the review and especially Swim Mom 2002. That's not easy to share your story, and to be able to do that here is incredible. And we're glad we can hope to spread awareness.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, iTunes, Spotify, Audible, Amazon, Facebook, wherever you want to review us, we really do appreciate that. So thanks for taking that time out of your life to do that. And I just wanted to say too, since there's a lot of first timers here tonight, in every episode of Midwest Murder, one of us has done all the research and written the story. The other one does not know what the story will be about. So the reactions you're getting from that person are completely organic. And that's always an important reminder for first timers. This show is also brought to you in part by Midwest Memoirs. And this is all about capturing the stories of your family. If your family's history as spoken and the people in their voice of the people who you love, if that's important to you, if your stories are important to you, then you need to contact Midwest Memoirs, because we're here to ensure those stories and the voices who tell them are never forgotten. It's the best way to capture ancestry, to capture family history, and just to hear what was meaningful in the lives of the people that you love, or to tell what is meaningful about your life to future generations of your family. So Dawn and I do that. It's an amazing service. I think it makes us better people sitting and hearing those stories. If that sounds like something you'd be interested in, please contact Midwest Memoirs today on Facebook or Instagram.
And hearing the stories that people, when after they've listened to the stories that their family member has shared, hearing how touched they are, you know, and one thing that always strikes me as odd, and I know we have to get to the case, but one thing that always strikes me as odd is the problems never change. You've got somebody who's 97 who just wanted to make her dad proud. You've got someone who's 80 and misses their dad like they died yesterday. And it is just, and that is a constant theme throughout. And it's incredibly humbling to be a part of them, for sure.
Hearing a pretty gnarly 70-something-year-old Vietnam veteran shed tears because he misses his dad, it's a life-changing experience. Those are the memories we're capturing on Midwest Memoirs. And again, if that sounds like something that's meaningful to you and your family, contact us on Facebook or Instagram, Midwest Memoirs. This is a story tonight that takes us through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and into the early 80s. In the 50s, America experienced the prosperous World War II boom. Jobs were abundant. Suburban communities sprouted up.
So were babies.
Right. Yes. Babies too. More people were buying new cars. Elvis Presley became an icon. But fear of communism was rampant. And the civil rights movement, sparked by events like Brown versus the Board of Education and activists such as Rosa Parks, would carry over to the 60s. In the 60s, the civil rights movement fully arrived. So too did the Vietnam War, massive protests, Pop-Tarts, the Beatles, and the first star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, Joanne Woodward.
Oh, do you know who she was married to?
No.
Paul Newman.
Okay, right on. Yeah. We got Johnny Carson in the 60s, Alcatraz closed, miniskirts hit the market, thank you.
Oh,
and,
God.
And Woodstock closed the decade. At the turn of 1970, Led Zeppelin were quickly becoming the biggest stars in music. Vietnam came to a close. Nixon resigned as, quote, not a crook over the Watergate scandal. People magazine debuted. Starbucks opened its first store. The women's rights movement, counterculture, Star Wars, and Sony released the first Walkman in 1979.
Heck yeah.
Then we arrive to 1981. The year MTV, the Smurfs, the People's Court with Judge Wapner, Metallica, and the McRib all made their debut. Some of those things are still good. I'll leave it to you to determine which.
Huh.
Reagan took office. Prince opened for the Rolling Stones to nearly overwhelming boos.
I would fight everyone in that audience. I would fight everyone by myself.
Well, we know what side of history they're on, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the wrong one.
The wrong one. And in 1981, approximately 750 million people watched Princess Diana marry Prince Charles.
We know how that ended.
Not great.
Yeah. Anybody watch The Crown? Yeah? No? You guys got to watch more. You got to watch The Crown for real.
So
sorry, I'm yelling at you.
That brings us to the little border village of Skidmore, home to around 450 residents and two paved roads. It was in 1981 mostly untouched by modern culture. So no video stores, no arcade, no bowling alley, none of that. It rests in the northeast corner of Missouri, 30 minutes from both Iowa and Nebraska. Most of the residents in Skidmore are generational. This is the kind of blue-collar town where everyone really does know one another, and families date back to the inception of the town. Most who live in Skidmore...
So outsiders are really welcome there, is what you're saying?
Totally
yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah, okay.
Very not. Most who live in Skidmore can drive down Main Street and quickly assess who's where and doing what based on where the vehicles are parked. But as we've learned time and again on Midwest Murder, no small town is without miscreants. On a well-maintained gravel road several miles into the prairie, through pastures and farmlands, is where Kenneth Rex McElroy grew up. To his friends, he was Ken or Kenny. To everyone else, he was simply McElroy.
Is it McElroy or McElroy?
I say McElroy.
Sure.
But it could be McElroy.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Forgive me for calling you out right away on the name.
We're really early in the call-outs.
I know. Yeah.
Maybe Google it while I'm reading. Born on June 16th, 1934, McElroy was the least favorite son of his parents, who were poor farmers who lived in the Ozarks before becoming tenant farmers in the Midwest. And he was the least favorite of, like, a dozen kids. So when I say least favorite, he's way down the list. As tenant farmers, his family lived in someone else's house, tended their land, worked long days in their fields, and lived at near poverty levels. By the mid-40s, seemingly every member of the McElroy clan, 18 of them in all, including 13 siblings and some of their kids, piled into an old farmhouse down Valley Road outside Skidmore. Everyone contributed to family chores except Ken, who, in a lot of ways, was feral.
Well, no wonder he wasn't the favorite. He wasn't pulling his weight. Lazy, lazy bastard. Like, get to work, kid. Yeah. What are you, a fifth grader? Come on.
It might have helped him be better.
Yeah.
You'll see. So, feral McElroy got held back twice in fifth grade. So by sixth grade, he was 3 to 4 inches taller than the next kid and at best half as smart. On his first bus ride, McElroy got into a scuffle, pulled a knife, and threatened to shank the other boys.
So I what does it mean to not be the favorite? I mean, was there abuse involved? Was there... it was the 50s, so, love was abuse at that point.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. Nobody gave two F's about him.
Sure.
There is no clear abuse that came up in the research
okay.
I have.
Okay.
Aside from, no sexual abuse that came
right.
up. But
physical abuse.
Physical, physical abuse that it was just harsh living, hard living, not like his dad was dragging him in the woodshed and
sure.
just strapping him and whipping him or anything.
Okay.
But... he probably caught the occasional backhand. I don't know. McElroy once got caught stealing from the gas station. But when the owner called Ken's father, it didn't go quite how you'd expect. Papa McElroy later burst into the store with a long hunting knife, slammed the owner into a wall, and told him, "If you ever touch my boy again, I'll cut your fucking heart out."
Oh, okay. That is not how I expected that to go. You are correct. So, yeah.
Won't be the last surprise. Never having learned to fully read or write, McElroy dropped out of school in the eighth grade. After that, he pretty much just wandered the land on his horse, fully armed, often with a dog, hunting and trapping along the river. McElroy truly personified the 1950s bad boy. His hair was slick back, dark black, his shirt sleeves were rolled up, smoking cigarettes all the time. He was like the Fonz, if you could buy the Fonz from a Dollar General.
So he was like a... He was a greaser. He was, yeah.
Before dropping out of school, he was known to sneak younger girls into the bushes while his buddy John kept a lookout. So riding horses, training dogs, hunting, sneaking girls into the woods, pedophilia, and being thieving little bastards became their way of life. Ken acquired a 1936 Ford, ripped out the back seat, slapped down plywood, and started using that to steal grain from farmers. They'd pack it to the roof. Then they'd sell that, no questions asked, to local elevators. People said McElroy could steal anything not bolted down, especially your underage daughter.
Oh, boy. Okay.
In 1952, at the age of 18, Ken married a 16-year-old girl. This will be the oldest woman he ever marries.
Oh.
And the two scurried off to Denver, where Ken gave honest work his last worst effort. He was injured at a construction job site and never worked again. By 1956, the couple returned to Missouri, and McElroy returned to hog thieving. He could steal a handful of hogs each week and then sell them for $50 to $60 each. McElroy's reputation in the region grew. He became known for sex, drinking, stealing, and violence. Word was, McElroy liked him young, and he liked him poor. Rumors of rape followed him everywhere, but nothing ever came from it.
Because the poverty-stricken young girls aren't going to say shit. That's why.
And if they do, they don't have the means or the resources. There's nothing established, especially in a small area like this, to help them.
Dang.
It's a whole thing. So Ken hopped all over the small towns, slept around. He always had women with him at the bar. From what I gathered, it was in 1956 or 57 that a 15-year-old farmer's daughter gave birth to McElroy's firstborn son. So he would have been about 20 at that time. In case you were wondering, yes, Ken is still married to his first wife, Aletta, at this point, and he has her name tattooed on his knuckles. By 1958, he was also sleeping with 15-year-old Sharon. Sharon claimed she was drawn to his style and strength. Sharon was a little more independent. The two fought regularly. During one of those fights, Ken pulled a shotgun and threatened to blow her fucking head off.
Those are his words, not yours.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Those were his words.
Nice.
The weapon accidentally discharged and tore open the area below Sharon's chin.
Oh.
Police were called and charges were filed. But to, quote, make things right, Ken divorced Aletta and married Sharon.
No, so that is the biggest red flag of them all.
By...
Like, that is... No.
Flags are going to get redder.
Oh, no.
More red. Excuse my grammar. So by make things right, I think he really meant to avoid being charged for assault with a deadly weapon. It worked, and the charges were dropped.
Oh, man. This is not going to go well, and we're only like a couple pages in.
It always gets worse. In July of 1959, Sharon gave birth to Jerome, and the two moved out to the McElroy farm. There, Jerome was left mostly unattended while Ken and Sharon did whatever they did. After the baby nearly got ran over while sitting down in the driveway, McElroy's sister Helen returned from California and took Jerome back with her. He's gone.
Thank you, Helen.
Yeah. In 1961, Sharon gave birth to Tammy Sue. Then Sharon turned up one day in a panic, baby in hand, at the sheriff's office later that year. Ken had locked them up in the house and left them for 2 days. Sharon was terrified of what would happen when McElroy discovered her escape. She told police he regularly beat her. A social worker relocated Sharon and the child with a foster family. That's when the foster family learned that Ken was keeping another young girl at the farm, 14-year-old Sally. The two were regularly subjected to his appetite for sexual violence. He took them any time and any way that he wanted. 6 weeks later, before an arrest warrant could be served...
Sharon's like 17 years old at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. She's about 16, 17.
Oh, my.
Somewhere in there. So McElroy found out where Sharon was being stashed, And he convinced a judge to sign off on a meeting at the prosecutor's office where he sweet-talked Sharon with promises of bringing Jerome back from California. Sharon subsequently refused to be a witness. That case was closed, and the cycle continued for both her and Sally. McElroy once dumped Sally, torn clothes and bleeding, in the middle of the street, looking as though she'd been attacked by animals. A couple brought her to the hospital, but when she attempted to press charges, McElroy threatened to kill her father. By 1965, Sally had birthed three of Ken's children and Sharon four. At one time, they were both in the Fairfax hospital having McElroy's baby.
Good grief.
Not long after Sally had his third child, McElroy abandoned her.
Well, the children, I'm glad. Good for her.
It's like, better for the, yeah. Yeah. The children were placed under temporary foster care where they were well-loved for several years and had little to no knowledge of who their parents were. Although Sally had parental visitation, she never came. Parental rights were eventually terminated and the kids were all shipped off. McElroy also abandoned Sharon shortly after this and the four kids that he had from her, and he left them on the farm in Skidmore so he could move in with his new chick, Alice, over in St. Joe. More on her in a minute. Hagen cattle thieving was now an expansive and sophisticated enterprise thanks to McElroy's vast network of girlfriends throughout the region. He stole them, they sold them, in exchange for sex and a little something extra. Police were convinced McElroy was running a ring of thieves, stealing grain, expensive chemicals, equipment, and farm animals throughout Missouri, Nebraska, and Kansas, but could never prove it or get enough evidence to make it stick. As silly as it might sound, poor record keeping at feed houses, farms, and slaughter pens helped McElroy get away with almost all of this. There was no branding, there was no record keeping, and they couldn't keep track of anything that was stolen. So anytime he got accused, that's my stolen hog, prove it. Well, I can't. All right, I guess it's not your stolen hog then. And he was always a step ahead of police. At least one woman filed charges and then dropped them. A farmer also pressed charges on McElroy for horse thievery, but he also backed off after McElroy smashed him in the face with a rifle. Oh. Oftentimes, people who spoke out loud about McElroy being a thief would later have buildings burned down on their property. So, Alice, a 13-year-old runaway.
No.
Yeah. A 13-year-old runaway who escaped an abusive, neglectful, and alcoholic home met Ken when she was young, naive, and easy to control and manipulate.
Because we go to what is familiar.
Yeah. She was a regular target of his beatings and sexual violence. The slightest wrong look or even another man saying hi to her in the street could trigger a beating from McElroy. And each time he hit her, Ken made sure to tell Alice how it was her fault. All the ways in which this beating from my Oletta tattooed fist is your fault.
That is the control. That is why it is not easy for people to leave. It's because they brainwashed them as well.
And he always had a bunch of women, his whole network of girlfriends, allies, as I said. And Alice came to accept the other women in his life. And she could tell when he had a new girl because he was nice to her. One of Ken's favorite things to do, he told Alice, was to sleep with rich farmers' wives because they couldn't possibly give them the satisfaction he does.
Hold on. I want to unpack this one for a second.
Yeah.
To sleep with, have sex with the rich farmers' wives.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't give the men the satisfaction.
Men could not give the wives the satisfaction that Ken can give them.
Well, yeah, he's probably right. But Ken couldn't either.
I agree.
Oh, dear.
In 1968, Alice gave birth to their first son.
Forgive me. I thought he was telling Alice to sleep with them.
No.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I was like, yeah. They probably can't give him the same that Alice does. So Okay.
Yeah. The husbands can't give them.
Gotcha. I apologize. Thank you for somebody being on my page. I appreciate that.
So in 1968, Alice gave birth to their first son. Sharon and the four kids moved to Florida. Beyond his network of girlfriends, McElroy had henchmen, a lot of younger men who totally worshipped him. After a county warehouse was robbed twice in early 1968, they hired an elderly security guard and armed him with a shotgun. Days later, the guard unloaded a round of buckshot at some thieves. After a few months, detectives learned McElroy had pellets removed from his ass. They found the doctor and linked the buckshot to the security guard's weapon. Using that as corroborating evidence, five charges of theft and burglary were filed against McElroy in 1971. Warrants were issued, sent to the sheriff's office, but never executed.
So why protect him then? Why are they afraid of him? Like, what's happening?
Fear. They were afraid. They were afraid to do anything to him for fear of anything he might do.
It's 1971. He's been doing this garbage since 1956.
Yeah, we're like, about 15 years in or so.
Good grief.
And he's only gotten better at it over the years. In April of 1972, Alice escaped to her parents' house. So McElroy calls, threatens to kill everyone and take the baby. Alice grabs a .32 caliber pistol, takes up a spot at the kitchen table waiting for McElroy, and accidentally shoots herself in the hip.
Oh, no.
She gets sent to the hospital, but McElroy wasn't done. He calls again, tells the stepfather, same night, tells the stepfather, Otha, I'm coming to get my kid, and I will kill anyone who stands in my way. Otha grabs a shotgun and starts patrolling the house. But when he's standing at the window looking outside, bam, a bullet shatters the window and takes him through the left thigh. Felony charges were filed 3 months later. In response, McElroy began threatening the kids as well as Alice's mother. He also murdered their dog.
Oh, come on. Like, I know, I mean, humans are one thing, and then, but then you escalate to the animals and it's just like, dude, if you don't like the humans, please don't kill them, right? Obviously.
Right.
But what did that dog do? It's just, I'm sure South Dakota is asking the same question, right?
Ooh. Okay.
Sorry.
Zing.
Sorry. Sorry. Woo. I did not mean to pull. It's my birthday tomorrow. That's why. Okay.
So Otha didn't back down after that. Then in January of 1973, Otha was having drinks at Garland's Tavern in downtown St. Joe on a busy night when McElroy suddenly burst in with a semi-automatic 12-gauge shotgun, barricaded the door so no one could leave, and shoved the shotgun in Otha's face, screaming, "You better not testify." McElroy waved the gun around and then fired a round into the floor, inches from Otha's feet, said, quote, "I'll blow your goddamn head off if you testify." And he stormed out. Felony charges of threatening a witness were filed in response to that. That's when McElroy made friends with talented, well-connected lawyer Richard McFadden. McElroy paid him $3,000 in cash. Days later, all the charges were dropped down to misdemeanor offenses. When the case was later tried in 1973, the bartender testified that he didn't see anything. This led to a conviction and a conviction, air quotes, and a six-month sentence, but that didn't stick. On May 4th, McFadden filed an appeal for a new trial. Then on May 5th, the files were mysteriously sealed and the case was closed.
Out of fear, not a good enough excuse, but serious, like nothing is sticking to this guy whatsoever.
Nothing. Now, when McElroy didn't like a certain sheriff, he focused efforts in that county. One such stint led to more than $100,000 in livestock going missing in just under 3 months. Angry farmers were swarming the sheriff's office, and that poor sheriff patrolled all night, every night from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m., but there was no pattern, and he never saw anything. Again, McElroy was always steps ahead of law enforcement.
That's about $703,000 today.
Yeah.
That's
it's no small amount of cattle.
That $100,000 is a big amount today, but like at that point, that's
right.
That is a lot.
Damn near a milli right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he had certainly graduated from shoving a few fat hogs into the back of his Ford to packing trailers, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, at first it sounded like, that sounds like an interesting job. Okay. But now it is just a joke. Like, now it's like, seriously, dude, just because he doesn't like the sheriff. So
yeah.
he's mocking them.
He's mocking them. And then again, it's why sheriffs didn't want to mess with him.
Sure.
Because shit like this would happen. So eventually, one good sheriff working together with another pretty decent highway patrol special agent, they picked up Alice and another of McElroy's girlfriends. After several days of questioning, the two women flipped, gave signed statements, and even showed the locations of several thefts. In February of 1972, prosecutors charged McElroy with four felonies, and police actually arrested McElroy four separate times.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's
right?
Nice.
It's petty and it's great.
I'm here for petty. Yeah. I like petty. Yeah.
And of course, they did that in an effort to make it more difficult and complicated for him to bail out each time. McElroy's lawyer, Richard McFadden, he had this motto. It went like this, quote, "You can call me cunning and devious just as long as you don't call me dishonest." Turns out...
Okay, that's icky, but...
Yeah. And it turns out he was really damn good at his job. And he really liked getting paid in cash from McElroy. Before the trial, Alice and Marcia, the other woman, swore their statements were all coerced. They recanted everything and the case collapsed. Well, Ken McElroy wasn't busy stealing hogs, beating charges, or as women, he was lurking outside middle and high schools.
Ew.
He'd intercept girls at the bus stop or after school. He started grooming young Trina at age 12. Trina's father and Ken McElroy were hunting buddies. A few years later, she was pregnant and dropping out of school in the ninth grade. By now, McElroy is about 35 years old. In June of 1972, Trina, her two-week-old baby, and Alice, along with the two kids she had by McElroy, tried to escape. But McElroy caught them in the act and chased them, high-speed pursuit, to Trina's parents' house, where he stood on the sidewalk with a gun, making psychotic threats. "I'll shoot people's limbs off. I'll kill everybody inside." So Trina and Alice eventually left with McElroy for fear of their families being hurt.
Yeah.
Later that night, McElroy smashed Alice's nose with the butt of a shotgun, breaking both her cheekbones as well as her brow. She managed to stumble away, get into a truck, and drive to the hospital in Fairfax. The next day, while Alice was in the hospital, McElroy forced Trina, who you might recall just had a baby a few weeks ago, into sex and fellatio. After that, he burned her parents' house down and killed their dog.
Good.
After raping their daughter. Alice returned, and she helped Trina make it to the doctor. Trina, of course, was in hysterics. She's been abused. Her family is, their house has been burned down. Juvenile authorities were contacted. Trina was placed in a mental hospital while the baby was put into foster care. Just wait. In the hospital, Trina went without access to counsel, interaction, or anyone asking if she was okay, nor was she given knowledge of her baby's whereabouts for 3 weeks. This is why we have children's advocacy centers.
She was placed in a mental hospital.
Yes.
Because she's the problem.
Well,
she
wasn't the problem. She was in hysterics. That's what they did. I'm not defending that choice. But yeah, that's what they did. They put her in there.
But I even hate the use of the word hysterics because they don't use that with a male. It's always
fair.
With a woman. She was hysterical. She was in hysterics. That drives me absolutely bonkers because that is how many women, in this case, a girl, have been placed in mental hospitals, in institutions because... You know, believe the husband or the guy who's raping her. He's got to be better character than that. Like that's what it comes down to.
It's insane. Mm. So Trina was eventually moved to a foster home at the Air Force Base in Knob Noster, Missouri. In June of 1973, police charged McElroy on the basis of Trina's statements with rape, arson, and threatening with a deadly weapon. All authorities had to do now was keep their witness from Ken McElroy. And it worked well for a time. McElroy had no chance of finding Trina on that Air Force base, and Trina shared disturbing accounts of violent sexual abuse with that foster family.
Oh.
Unfortunately, that Air Force couple got new orders, forcing a relocation of Trina, and a Maryville foster couple took her in. Back in McElroy's wheelhouse, they provided Trina with a nice space in the basement. They were great, loving people, and things went fine for a few weeks until McElroy found her and parked outside. He sat there for hours. Police were called. They arrived. They chased McElroy off, but he hadn't broken any laws. Then the phone calls began every single day, and he always referred to Trina as, quote, my little bride.
Oh.
The foster parents had two daughters about Trina's age. Once, he told the foster mother, I'll trade you girl for girl. I know your kids' bus routes.
Oh.
At a preliminary hearing in November of 1973, a magistrate agreed there was enough evidence for a trial, and he also added 8 charges of child molestation. The new charges were filed in February of 1974. McElroy was now looking at 12 felonies. Unfortunately, justice did not move fast enough, and McElroy's lawyer was just too good. McFadden filed a motion to transfer McElroy's cases to all their respective counties, splitting the charges up 4 and 8. Trial dates were set in late October and November of 1974, now several years after these incidents occurred. Then, Trina's grandparents showed up, demanded custody, and the court agreed to send her with her family. Trina was taken from foster care and placed with the grandparents. She hated it there, and you can probably guess what happened next. She called McElroy to come get her.
Oh.
His next move was to quickly marry 15-year-old Trina because a wife cannot testify against her husband. There was just one problem. He had to divorce Sharon first. So he divorced Sharon. Then he threatened Trina's mom's life so that she would sign off on the marriage. And lastly, McElroy found a dumb, sleazy old judge in Missouri to sign off on the wedding. McElroy and Trina were married 4 days before the trial was set to take place. On October 24th...
Look, those of you in 1973, how were you so blind? How is this allowed? Yes, times, they are a-changing, right? There's a song about it. But... I mean, at what point is this okay to people?
At no point. At no point is it okay.
Right. But at what point are people going to pay it? Like, going to like say,
it's insane.
No.
It's like it was an open secret that this guy was a pedophile, but it was all poor people. So nobody gave a shit.
Right.
It's kind of how it came. It's kind of how it looks.
It's that's how it feels, you know, a few years later.
So on October 24th, all the rape and molestation charges against McElroy were dropped. He had a motto, no witness, no case. McElroy has now beaten 19 felony charges. I know we don't do a lot of math here, but I did that one. 19 is where we're at. Now, he told Alice that she had to move out because he promised Trina she'd be his only woman now. Trina gave birth to their second child in April of 1975. Alice happily moved out, if not quite all the way on. She gave birth to Ken's third child from her on September 20th, 1975, 11 months after his marriage to Trina.
Okay. Okay.
About 10 kids now, if you're doing that math.
Yeah.
It's about where approximately 10 children. In the midst of all this, McElroy had an almost separate life.
How? How does he have the time?
Like, it's a fair question.
He's spending like hours upon hours outside of his victim's parents' homes. Like, how does he have time? Shouldn't he be thieving? Like,
think at night.
When does he sleep?
He might not.
Even creepers have to sleep. Yeah. Like,
you're not wrong.
Yeah.
So he had this separate life where he was utterly respected, even legendary. And it was in the coondog world, raising, breeding, and trading coonhounds. Many of his champion dogs sold for $2,000 to $3,000. And he was never known to show anger in this crowd or at the dog tracks or the shows. His hair was slicked back. He wore slacks, nice fancy tall cowboy boots. He always drove a brand new pickup and flashed massive wads of cash. And McElroy always, always carried a 38 pistol and a custom leather holster beneath his shoulder, and he never sat with his back to a door. And lastly, no one at any point ever has testified to ever seeing McElroy get into a fist fight. Ever.
Well, then he must be a good guy. Okay.
Must be. In addition to his extensive network of cattle thieving, McElroy also fenced stolen goods for organized criminals, and he earned $10,000 to $15,000 each for burning buildings as part of an insurance scam. Some of McElroy's best thieves started when they were 14 years old, and these boys grew up to love and admire him. He treated them well and paid them good money to steal. In their words, they said, "Farmers pay us shit money to do shit work. I'd rather work for McElroy." These boys also served as liaisons for McElroy's pedophilia.
Oh.
When it came to identifying people for the things he wanted, Ken McElroy was an apex predator. One of these young men once helped McElroy hold a man spread eagle across the train tracks until the train rolled over him. In July of 1976, McElroy targeted a married local farmer and father of three, Romaine Henry. He was living just outside of Skidmore for some perceived slight. McElroy talked to one of his girlfriends or crossed his land or something. So McElroy ambushed Romaine on the gravel roads into pulling over and then came through the passenger door, blasted him across the guts with a shotgun, splattering flesh and stomach against the driver's side door, fired again. The shot glanced off Romaine's head, tore his skull open. Romaine falls out of the truck. McElroy, stalking around the truck, his gun jams. The farmer hops back up, gets in his truck, and steps on it with McElroy in fast pursuit. Several witnesses saw the chase. No one saw the ambush, and Romaine managed to escape. McElroy was arrested the following day and charged with felony assault with intent to kill. McElroy had a simple defense. I wasn't there. And you can bet he had an alibi to say that he wasn't. Through a series of continuances, the trial was pushed back to August of 1977. A local magistrate's farm burned down. Locals recalled the train story. At the jury trial in August, two witnesses testified they were out coon hunting with McElroy, and everyone else was too afraid to testify honestly, and he was unanimously acquitted after 2 hours of deliberation. When the verdict was read, his lawyer, McFadden, winked and smiled at McElroy. He has now beaten 20 felony charges. By 1978, McElroy, Trina, their two kids, some of his parents and several of his siblings, as well as three of his daughters from Sharon, were all living on the farm outside Skidmore. In early 1980, a new marshal won the badge in Skidmore by 4 votes, a big, young, strong man, former wrestler, who moved to Skidmore the previous year. Townsfolk warned him, "McElroy might blow your head off." So he bought a gun and, with no training whatsoever, pinned a badge on his shirt and became the law.
What is this, like 1880? Like,
pretty much. This is not considered a formal position in the town at all. Everything there is volunteer. Volunteer marshal, volunteer firefighters.
Yeah, pretty soon Wyatt Earp's going to show up. I mean, it's like, it just...
He needs to. We're missing him.
Like, I think I like Bell Gunness more than I like this guy. Yeah. And I hate Bell Gunness. I hate the whole story. I hate all of it. It is not my favorite. Wonderful writing,
yeah,
but just, I cannot with her. This guy, like, she at least had some, this is not me defending her, but she at least had some rhyme and reason
to her,
you know, murdering.
Yeah.
This guy just has nothing. He's a disgusting, pedophile. I can't even come up with words. Like, this is,
he's my first nominee for the Mount Rushmore of scumbags.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, his face is number one for me.
Yeah. That makes sense.
In April of 1980, an altercation at B&B Grocery in Skidmore would mark the beginning of the end.
Well, thank you.
I didn't say it was for McElroy.
Oh, man.
B&B Grocery, family owned and operated by 49-year-old Lois, a tough and stern but goodly woman, and her 69-year-old husband, Bo Bowenkamp, a gentle giant of a man who stood at 6'5". The altercation happened on April 25th. The short and skinny of it, one of McElroy's teenage daughters, along with one of McElroy's toddlers, became hostile in the store after the toddler was asked to pay for candy that she was about to walk out with. Moments later, Trina burst into the store and screamed, "Who the fuck is accusing my kids of trying to raid your shitty store?" Mm. So that escalated quickly.
And Trina just needed a hug. I don't want to, and a lot of therapy. I don't want to, I'm not going to judge her reaction to that, because that's what, unfortunately, she has been raised with, because her husband's raising her at this point.
Yes.
Ugh, ew, that was just icky to say.
Lois tried explaining that nobody accused anyone of anything. The child wasn't paying for the candy. So Trina said, "Our family will never shop here again."
Okay.
Lois was like, "All right, noted. Get the fuck out of my store." A few hours later, several feral women burst into the store behind Ken McElroy and screamed obscenities for 5 straight minutes while McElroy manicured his fingernails with a huge hunting knife. An elderly woman at the front of the store froze and nearly fainted. The milkman ducked into the cooler and hid. Bo and Lois held their ground. After an intense back and forth, McElroy asked to buy a cigarette so he could leave, to which Lois replied, "Sir, I understand that nobody in your family wishes to do business at this store."
I like her.
"Fine," said McElroy, and he left with his posse of feral women and children.
Ugh.
The new marshal had been on the job for less than 2 weeks. 4 days later, the onslaught of harassment began when a caravan of trucks driven by McElroy's gun-toting clan ripped up and down the street where Bo and Lois lived. Lois stared them down. They stopped and stared back for a time and then sped off. Next, McElroy confronted Lois in the street and he offered her $100 to fight Trina. He said, "I'll give you a $100 bill if you try and whip my old lady's ass right here in the street." And Trina was over there like, "Bitch, I will fuck you up."
Like, okay.
And he waved $100 in Lois's face.
Okay, first of all.
Trina really did also say that, just for the record. I didn't add that.
I hate when people are like, "My old lady."
I hate it.
I hate it so much. And also, your old lady is still a freaking child, so that doesn't work.
I thought it was your little bride, pervert.
Right, like...
You want to whip my old lady's ass?
She's 9 years older than me at this point.
You're old enough to be my old lady's mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Lois is like, "This is bullshit," and she left with Bo. A few hours later, McElroy parked a truck with a camper top just down the street from their house, got out and pulled the hood up. "Aw, shucks, I got some car trouble here." Lois's parents came over to back them up and they called the highway patrol. But minutes after they made that call, McElroy left. Inside the camper, McElroy had all of the latest and best radio equipment and technology, so he always heard what police were up to. It's why he was always a step ahead. So when HP arrived, he was long gone, and officers told the Bowen Caps, "Oh, shucks, there's nothing we can do." 45 minutes later, after they left, McElroy returned, parked with his hood up.
Where is the Wyatt Earp guy? He has got to save the day here. This is how the story ends, right?
He's not coming. Lois didn't bother calling the police a second time. She felt like they were on their own. Now, this went on for months. He showed up at their house every single day, and the harassment extended to their oldest daughter, Cheryl. So McElroy would follow Cheryl home, and when she parked in the driveway, he would creep on by and stare daggers at her. He'd bring his hounds, and he would let them howl outside the Bowen camp house for hours late at night. In late May, McElroy fired his shotgun over their house twice, left, then came back and did it again. The incident was reported to sheriffs, who said they'd write a report and send it off to the prosecutor. It was illegal to discharge a firearm in the city.
Oh, yeah, because that one's going to stick. Yeah. Yeah, good one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing was ever done. After nearly 2 months, Lois finally turned to the newly elected marshal and pleaded for help. To his credit, the following day, the marshal confronted McElroy, who was parked outside the Bowen camp home, and asked if he'd been shooting outside their house. Probably just fireworks, McElroy said. The marshal locked eyes with McElroy, shook his head, and walked away. 2 days later, while the marshal was playing with his kids in the front yard of his house, McElroy's caravan of gun-toting ferals rotted up and down his street. So aside from their own family and one set of neighbors, everyone in Skidmore slinked back from the Bowen camps, and everyone said, oh, don't worry, he'll move on eventually. At the beginning of July,
Who says that after two decades? Like, oh, he's going to move on eventually, it'll be fine.
He'll find someone new to harass. It won't be you forever.
Oh, boy.
At the beginning of July, just after Beau's 70th birthday, McElroy caught the old man behind the shop in the alley, cutting and stacking boxes. There were four young boys sitting on a truck across the street. McElroy gave him some money, told him to go inside the tavern and get a soda. One of the kids told the barkeep that McElroy was about to thump old man Bowenkamp. In response, the bartender locked the doors to his tavern. Moments later, they all heard the loud burst of gunfire, followed immediately by squealing tires. After a few minutes, one of them finally worked up the courage to look out the window, and they saw Beau laying in the street. They found him bleeding profusely from two holes in his neck. Beau was trying to talk, trying to say something, but he was swallowing and gurgling too much blood to get it out. When they finally tied a shirt around his neck and held it there to slow the bleeding, he managed to gurgle out one word, McElroy. The marshal arrived quickly, expecting a shootout, but McElroy was long gone. Patrolmen arrived 30 minutes later. The ambulance took another 20 minutes. It was nearly 2 hours after being shot before Beau Bowenkamp finally arrived at the ER, where a surgeon, a former combat medic, performed life-saving surgery and removed two bullets of buckshot from Beau's neck.
30 minutes?
That's how far in the sticks they were.
Oh, yep. Right. Because I was like, you could throw a rock from like one side of Main Street to the other. Are you?
That is how far they were from actual services, from a highway patrol, from ambulance.
All right. Sorry,
all
I blew
that.
Up then. Yeah. I apologize on that one.
So over the years, happening concurrently to McElroy's career as an all-around piece of shit was the rise of Northern Missouri's most respected lawman, Corporal Richard Dean Stratton, nickname Sarge. Now, Stratton kept tabs on McElroy and pulled him over every chance he got for every little thing that he could. The latter, McElroy, avoided the former, Stratton, at all costs. People said Stratton was the one cop McElroy was afraid of. When the radio call came through that McElroy was wanted and on the run, it was Stratton who nailed him after making a brilliant, educated guess predicting McElroy's backroads route when he was fleeing. He knew he wasn't going to be on the interstate, and he predicted where he would be, caught him. Stratton boldly made the arrest against orders to wait for backup. Shotgun in hand, drawn, safety off, way out in the country, no one to back him up in a two-on-one confrontation between himself and Trina and McElroy. But McElroy came out, hands up, didn't F around, and he asked, what am I being arrested for? Did something happen? No evidence related to the shooting was found in the vehicle, and he was released on a $30,000 bond the next morning. He didn't even actually have to pay the bond. You just had to write that you're good for it. And then he was out before most people realized it. The very next evening, McElroy strutted into the crowded D&G Tavern in downtown Skidmore, openly sneering. The bar emptied within minutes. The cops had finally done their job, and the courts let this guy loose, and now he was flaunting it. Self-defense, he told everyone. Self-defense. I'd shot Bowen. Self-defense.
Yeah.
Some people in Skidmore felt that Lois Bowenkamp was reaping what she sowed for being such a hard ass and not backing down to the McElroy clan and selling them cigarettes. One of their lone supporters who visited Bo every day in the hospital, Bo was hospitalized for over a month, by the way. He visited him every day. This old priest, Warren, the priest regularly endured death threats over the phone from McElroy and his clan, not to mention constant visits from the gun-toting caravan of feral women.
I think, be careful calling them feral women.
Oh, they're feral by this point.
They are victims at this, I mean, through and through.
Of them. I mean, at some point you're willfully engaging in what is going on. And we only know Trina as a victim. He had girlfriends everywhere that were working for him, setting up through his network. At some point you're crossing a line.
But at what point is it not a cult, basically? It could be compared to like a cult.
That's not, yeah, it's right? Fair comparison. It's fair comparison. It doesn't make him not feral.
Yeah.
These things aren't mutually exclusive. Now.
Yeah. I don't have a response to that, I guess.
Yeah. McElroy started coming to Skidmore daily, actively intimidating anyone who might testify. He'd show up to D&G Tavern. The tavern would empty out. And then he would sit there drinking alone, smoking cigarettes, chewing on Rolaids, and staring at the bartender for hours. Now, once upon a time, McElroy was a pretty good-looking man, they say, but now, not so much. At 5 feet 10 inches tall, he was broad-shouldered, thick-armed, and barrel-chested with a massive beer gut. He constantly looked bloated and was considered medically obese, weighing, by some reports, 270 pounds, other reports, 230 pounds. He was also covered in cheap tattoos. He had a cross with the word mom. He had his own name, as I mentioned before. Yeah, name.
He tattooed his own name?
On a dagger, no less.
I mean.
He had the name of his first wife, Oletta, on his knuckles. So, McElroy looked like a biker villain who was about to get his ass kicked by Steven Seagal. Sons of Anarchy would have hired him as an extra in an instant. And terrorizing the people of Skidmore became McElroy's full-time job. He'd call the wives of witnesses and tell them their children are going to die if their husband testifies. On August 10th, on the third night of the annual Pumpkin Festival, yes, not pumpkin, Pumpkin, that's what they called it, more than 2,000 people are in town attending, and there is a man who crossed McElroy at a tavern when he said something to the effect of, you know, if you're such a good shot and coon hunter, why'd you miss those two old boys? Bad idea. McElroy would set up ambushes by luring people into an alley where feral ass Trina and Tammy Sue were waiting in the shadows with shotguns. This is what McElroy did to this guy, threatened to kill him. This guy talked his way out of the ordeal and moved out of town the next week. The next night of the festival, McElroy did the same ambush on the new marshal and threatened to murder his family if he testified. When the marshal called headquarters for backup, the response was, quote, well, if we arrest McElroy, he'll just be out in a few hours and he'll come back angrier and more hostile than before. There's nothing we can do, so just keep your eye on him. He won't do anything.
What has he been doing the last 30 years? What? He won't do anything?
I guess nothing. So the newly elected marshal resigned the next day after about 4 months. So during many of the hostile ambush encounters, witnesses claimed McElroy could signal and control his band of women in the same way he did his coon dogs. The threatening harassment of Skidmore went on daily until the preliminary trial on August 18th. There were only two witnesses who would stand in the end, Bo and the first highway patrolman who arrived on scene. Surprisingly, the charges stuck, and a trial date was set for 3 weeks away. But the ever-resourceful McFadden motioned for a change of venue just days before the trial was to take place. Now, the judge granted that change, even though the request didn't meet even the minimum requirements to make such a change. Apparently, the judge was afraid of McElroy burning his house down. Another trial date was set for December, and McElroy felt more untouchable than ever. He also seemed to know when Stratton's wife was home alone and always made it a point to drive by and scare her when she was by herself. A woman once called and threatened Stratton's unborn baby. Then there was an incident in September over in the next county where Trina and McElroy rammed a couple and their six-month-old child off the road, forced them to stop, and then McElroy put his sawed-off shotgun in the man's face while crazy-ass Trina threatened to rip the woman out of the car and beat the shit out of her even though she was holding a baby. Feral. McElroy was arrested and released on a $10,000 bond. So
wow.
He was arrested after menacing the couple in the road rage incident. Now he openly threatened to burn the house down of anyone who testified. No witnesses came forward in this incident. The couple even tried to back off and rescind their statements, but the county insisted on prosecuting. That trial eventually happened in December. But the couple perjured themselves on the stand, and the jury found McElroy not guilty. He has now beaten 21 felonies. Now,
I am getting really annoyed.
Well, if you're not boiling with frustration yet, just wait till you hear this. Lois Bowenkamp wrote letters to every figure of authority she could think of. First to her state representative, a coward. He forwarded her letter to the head of the Missouri Department of Public Safety, also a coward, who said it was a local law enforcement issue. Her senator said he had no intention of interfering with the affairs of the attorney general. The attorney general said he had no jurisdiction, and the governor never responded.
The attorney general had no what?
Yeah. Yeah, I have no jurisdiction over there.
You have the jurisdiction. You are the head of that jurisdiction.
You have every jurisdiction.
You have all of them. All yours.
That's what he told her.
I'm just kind of over this already, man. This guy sucks.
$20,000 in chemicals were stolen from a store in the small town of Tarkio. McElroy was declared the chief suspect across police radio. When his lawyer, Richard McFadden, caught wind of that, he sent the highway patrol demanding a letter of apology for besmirching his client's good name on police radio.
Besmirching?
Besmirching, yeah.
It's a really good word.
HP sent a letter back stating they weren't aware of such an incident, but they would bring McFadden's letter to the attention of their patrolman. McElroy took that as an apology and carried the letter with him everywhere, proudly displaying it and declaring that Missouri Highway Patrol was kissing his ass.
I am not a fan of vigilante justice by any means. We have these systems in place, even when they fail us, but we have these systems in place. This is, and frankly, it was the 80s. Nobody gave a shit. Just go for it at that point. just run with it. There's
someone.
Who else is going to take this guy down?
Batman.
Yeah.
Even if the road rage charges didn't stick. Now, here's the thing. McElroy should have had his bond revoked for violating the terms of that bond.
Yeah, but 19 times ago.
Yes. But instead of revocation, the judge just modified it and said, well, McElroy, you can no longer carry a gun, and I'm going to go ahead and restrict you to these five counties. You're grounded to these five counties that just so happen to be the five fucking counties you're terrorizing. So that's one kind of solution.
That's because that's where his child brides were from. Those are the five counties. Come on.
Everyone who lived in the area officially felt the rule of law did not apply to Ken McElroy, nor would it protect any of them.
Wow.
McElroy didn't need to carry a gun. Everywhere he went, he had 3-4 trucks of gun-toting ferals packing heat, and they followed him everywhere. As the trial date of December approached for the case with Bo, McFadden continued his weaselly yet cunning procedural ways and brought to attention a major mistake made by that judge, Don. Those travel restrictions, lawfully placed on McElroy, actually prevented him from meeting with his lawyer. Now they were going to need more time to prepare for trial. Realizing his error, the judge agreed to another continuance, pushing the trial back to February 5th of 1981. And it was a constant game. McElroy knew that these continuances would allow him to intimidate, pressure, and put fear into people. It was what they did, so he continued with that pressure. He would call the relatives of witnesses and describe what the inside of their home looked like the books they had on their damn bookshelf, Don. And you know what? They asked him, how do you know that? And his reply, because I can see it clearly through the scope of my rifle.
Ugh.
On December 23rd, McElroy paid for a fancy brand new Silverado, Chevy Silverado, with pure cash, just under $11,000.
And avocado toast is ruining the millennials and everybody. Yeah, $11,000, come on.
As the calendar turned to 1981, the harassment didn't let up. Stratton's wife was now carrying a gun and doing target practice. Stratton's captain wrote the governor himself and the attorney general and was told by them, there's nothing we can do. Now, at this point, Stratton had enough, and he more or less told commanding officers that he was going to kill McElroy. He said, it's going to be easy, and I can make it look legal. So Stratton planted word with a hog thief, allegedly the one who helped McElroy hold that guy over the train tracks. He was his game plan. He planted word that he was going to kill McElroy and anyone with him. And he wanted that information to get back to McElroy. Following that, the intimidation of Stratton and his wife stopped completely. And just as Stratton suspected, McElroy would not stand up to strength. In January, powerful state senator Richard Webster announced he had been retained by McElroy, and Webster's first action, get this, was to file a continuance for the trial since he'd be in legislative session during the scheduled trial date in February, and state law required the continuance to be granted, and the trial was moved. I know. Just the reactions to some of you out there is priceless. So the trial was moved to June 25th of 1981. Once again, this slimy bastard slipped his way between the weak points of a flawed judicial system. A system sometimes over-focused on what is written as law and how those laws should function, but completely lost on what is actually happening in the society said laws should apply to. At this point, McElroy was falling apart, constantly chewing Rolaids for stomach pain, smoking 2 to 3 packs of Pall Malls a day, which he chased each time with a cough drop. The doctor told him to stop wearing your fancy cowboy boots that make you look taller and more intimidating and start wearing New Balances because your feet are fat and swollen.
Wow. Okay.
He regularly spit blood mixed with lung butter.
Ew, ew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you guys.
Hang on.
Yeah.
I want to pause this for a second. Like, the judge is like, you need to wear New Balances. like, the judge is telling him.
His doctor told him that, but
oh.
Yes.
I thought it was a judge. I don't know why I thought it was a judge.
The judge should have backed the doctor up on it, let's be real.
Okay, that makes more sense. Well, I was like, you care more about his, you know, his swollen little feet now I get it. I'm sorry.
It's even more funny because if you were to ask any of these people years later, how tall was McElroy? Everyone said he was well over 6 feet tall. In reality, he's, you know, 5'10".
I was going to say, 5'3"?
But his cowboy boots always made him look taller. Mm-hmm. So, and he was told to quit drinking also. Instead, McElroy was drinking as much as 2/5 of Jack Daniels every day. In April of 1981.
Oh, can you imagine what he smelled like?
Ugh.
Ew.
His cheaper than jailhouse tattoos is glistening in his Jack Daniels sweat.
Ew.
In April of 1981, horking out some lung butter in front of you.
Bloody, bloody.
Just bloody. It's the worst kind.
Ugh.
In April of 1981, whenever McElroy's Silverado rolled into Skidmore, no matter what time of day it was, the whole town shut down. Pound your beer, sink your eight ball, final transaction. Everyone just went home for the day, done and over. At the end of April, the state prosecutor resigned.
Oh my gosh.
Now, that should have worked against him. It didn't. The guy who took over was a young, fierce, and highly intelligent. We should have worked against the people.
McElroy.
Because now, yeah, I should have worked in favor of McElroy against the people and their prosecution. Okay. The guy who took over was a young, fierce, and highly intelligent go-getter who previously worked as an intern on one of the cases where McElroy was astonishingly acquitted. This guy's name was David Baird. At the end of May, businesses closed no later than 6 p.m., even the tavern, and kids were called home at 4 p.m. McFadden just produced an exonerating witness, some dog lady who had a really great, not even slightly coincidental story of how she was actually there the day shit went down between McElroy and Bowenkamp, and it was surely self-defense. In June, McElroy offered to pay some teenagers to plant rattlesnakes in the jurors' mailboxes. The trial finally commenced on June 25th. David Baird adjusted the charges from attempted to kill to attempt to knowingly cause serious physical injury in an effort to increase the chances of conviction. Sure. It's a smart move. Now, this was a courtroom full of fireworks and diagrams and arguments, but it all really came down to McElroy's word versus Bo Bowenkamp's. In the end, the jury agreed to convict McElroy for second-degree assault and 2 years in prison. When this shit started, he was facing up to life in prison for attempted murder.
At least something stuck, though.
Kinda.
Something stuck. Well, kinda. At least he's going to prison.
No,
it's not
yet.
Justice. It is not justice.
No. The thing is, there's some weird Missouri laws that just wait.
Of course there is.
Yeah.
You know, because they're like, I'm sorry, people from Missouri, but you're borderline in the South.
Yes.
And like like a little bit of an identity crisis, right? Sorry, Southern people. I'm sorry.
The reason,
tomorrow's my birthday.
The reason. So it turns out because of Missouri law, the jury was ignorant to nearly all of the pre-altercation hostilities. They were led to understand the murder attempt was actually a disagreement over parking. The jury was entirely uninformed of McElroy's previous transgressions, and the judge only had power to reduce sentencing, not raise sentencing. Furthermore, McElroy walked out of the courtroom a free man because in Missouri, he had the right to file a motion for a retrial within 25 days. So basically, it's got to stick twice.
Well,
4 days after the conviction, McElroy waltzed into D&G Tavern in Skidmore carrying a classic World War II Army M1 rifle with a bayonet. Is that weird to you? Does something seem off? So he began showing it off proudly, and he was showing it to a really tough old World War II vet who happened to be one of the most respected men in the community, Pete Ward. After some flash, McElroy started bragging that he was going to use that rifle to gut Bo Bowenkamp like a pig before trial. Old Pete Ward stood up and said, "Like hell you will." And he marched out of the tavern with his sons, walked home, grabbed his own rifle, and took watch on the hill near the Bowenkamp's house with full intent to shoot McElroy on sight. McElroy got into his Silverado and drove the opposite direction out of town.
Of course he did, because he's actually afraid of it. Like, He's actually a fucking
pussy.
He is. Okay. I'll allow it today. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We don't normally talk like that, but in this case, it's warranted. So word of Pete's actions carried with the prairie winds and quickly became the talk of every cafe in Northwest Missouri. For nearly a decade, Ken McElroy held this region under a hypnotic spell of violence, intimidation, and fear. Pete Ward broke the spell. Pete then got four witnesses to sign affidavits that McElroy violated his bond. He turned that into the prosecutor. On July 2nd, Baird filed the paperwork to revoke the bond. In short, what McElroy did that night, around. Yeah.
Like, so
that,
it was illegal.
Yeah. It was illegal and arrestable on three levels. However, after that stuff was filed, neither the sheriff nor the judge moved to have McElroy arrested. McElroy, carrying his .38, later tried to ambush Pete Ward in the alley behind Pete's house. But he was creeping up like the little asshole that he was with his pistol, slinking up the alley. And one of the neighbors saw it and screamed, "Hey, McElroy's going to come and shoot you." So he called out the alarm. And of course, McElroy scurried off into the Silverado driven by Trina. Then he showed up the next day when Pete's wife was home alone in the yard, and he said something to her, said to her something to the effect of, "Nice house you got there. Be a shame if it burned down with you in it." A unity spread across Skidmore. People started traveling in packs. They were keeping lookout. Everyone was arming themselves. On July 5th, the hearing date was set for July 10th, and with that, a release of the names who Pete Ward got to sign as witnesses. They just had to hold out for 5 days. Pete Ward didn't want the witnesses to face this alone the way the Bowen camps had to, so he recruited more than 50 locals. Remember, an old World War II vet. His plan was for a line of steel trucks and farmers to escort the witnesses and pack the courtroom. On July 10th, the plan worked to perfection. Truckload after truckload of Skidmore men filed into town, occupying every parking spot on Main Street but one, a spot in front of the tavern. What most of them didn't yet know was that McFadden had successfully got a continuance and the trial date had been moved. I'm so sorry. I could just see so much disappointment about this. The trial date was moved to July 20th.
Like, you know, I talk about victims' rights and, you know, victims, like, I'm always for the victim, and I'm obviously never pro murder, like, ever.
Right.
But if you took out his attorney, he would be nothing. I mean,
right.
Work smarter here.
So there was just,
I can't believe I just said that.
There was just one condition to moving the trial that the judge put in place. McElroy was banned from entering Skidmore until after the trial. When McFadden called McElroy and told him about the ban, McElroy's response was, "No one tells me where I can and can't go."
Yeah, that paper wall is really going to keep him out. Yeah.
Right. Back in Skidmore, frustrations upon learning that the trial was moved again were rising with the July heat. And word spread, another failure of justice. But just as farmers were about to disperse and get back to the field for work, someone suggested they all meet up at the town Legion Hall to discuss how they would handle McElroy for the next 10 days. Nearly 60 men gathered at the Legion Hall for this meeting, and it was disorganized at best. Killing McElroy in an act of self-defense or while he was stealing hogs became very popular notions. But more sensible voices, like Pete Ward, discouraged violence. McElroy was finally going to jail for what he did. This time, he could not weasel his way out of it, and no one needed to risk being hurt or killed trying to confront him. Meanwhile, McElroy received word that Skidmore residents were all gathered for a meeting about him. Naturally, he couldn't resist. But for the first time since all this had begun, McElroy ordered his feral clutter of truck-driving wenchmen to stay home. Just he and Trina would go and see what this was all about. And they would go unarmed. It was just after 10 a.m. when they walked into D&G Tavern.
Like the balls on this guy. I mean.
Over at the Legion Hall, the men wanted to form a posse, set up patrols, and if possible, we'd really like to legally murder Ken McElroy in self-defense. Oh, and they wanted to be deputized about it too. So the sheriff showed up, Sheriff Estes, and he clarified by law, quote, "Anytime someone has drawn a gun and has it pointed at you, you've a total right to blow him away."
In this instance, is it like previous times as well? Like, well, he drew a gun on me like last year. Does that still count?
No.
Like,
no.
Okay.
Got to be real time.
Okay.
Now the sheriff's like, "Don't go doing that. But if he draws on you, you can shoot him.
Don't go doing that."
Yeah.
But, you know, wink, wink.
As the newly formed posse began discussing their 10-day defense plan with a strong agreement to avoid violence, word came back that McElroy was at the tavern. A momentary hush fell over the meeting until one guy said, "Let's go have a beer." The majority of those 50 men went toward the tavern. A few broke off from the main group to watch Main Street, and a couple went back to their shops. The sheriff got the fuck out of town.
Oh my gosh. Honestly, you know, you may think that's cowardly, but it's not. Because if he's not in town, he doesn't have to respond.
Sure. McElroy was sitting alone with Trina when the men began filing into D&G Tavern. Eventually, every seat in the bar was taken. Someone even had to jump behind the bar to help pour beers. The last guy in was forced to take literally the only seat open in the house next to, guess who? McElroy. Imagine that awkward conversation.
That would have been so fun.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Hard stares and an air of hostility suggested to McElroy it was time to leave. He bought a sixer of beer, a pack of Pall Malls, a stick of Rolaids, threw $10 on the bar, and slowly walked out.
All of that for $10?
Yeah, all that for $10 probably left a couple dollar tip.
Wow.
He was a generous tipper from what they say, actually. So men began pouring from the building behind him, spreading out in either direction. One guy leaned against the building, beer in hand. McElroy blatantly ignored all of them. He got into his Silverado, closed the door, started his truck, opened the Pall Malls, put a cigarette to his mouth, and just as he was about to light it, bam! A .30-30 caliber ripped into the back of McElroy's neck, destroying his tongue, splitting gums, shattering his teeth before finally exiting through the lower left cheek. The unlit cigarette, along with chunks of teeth, tongue, and flesh, splattered across the dashboard in an explosion of blood and glass.
That's descriptive.
The second shot to find his mark came from a .22 rifle. It was later determined to be fired from a little up the hill. It caught the upper part of McElroy's skull, bounced around in between his ears, ripping his brain apart. In all, 8 to 10 shots were fired at McElroy from at least 2 rifles and possibly a shotgun. Trina spilled out from the passenger side, screaming and covered in blood and human tissue. Everyone ducked for cover. It was over in less than 30 seconds, and people were fleeing in every direction. Someone poked their head into B&B Grocery, where the Bowen Camp family was, and said, "It's over now. You people can sleep tonight. Just stand behind us." Nobody called an ambulance.
Yeah. There is so much responsibility and blood on the hands of everybody in law enforcement and above, all the way to the state level.
You're damn right.
That just allowed this to happen.
Yes.
It should have never gotten to this point at all.
Some say McElroy's corpse baked in the sun for more than an hour before HP or ambulances arrived. Law enforcement was expecting to show up and see the scene of a violent gunfight, but quickly determined it was clearly an ambush. When word came over that McElroy had been shot, Highway Patrol didn't even believe it. They thought it was some prank. But when they arrived to see his Silverado with broken windows, engine still running, riddled with bullets, and damn near on fire, it looked like it was pulled from a war zone, and they knew shit got real. It was also very clear that it was an ambush. The first officer on scene noticed teeth, pieces of bone, blood, brain, and flesh that were splattered across the steering wheel and dashboard. Blood pooling on the floorboard was slowly oozing out over the door outside into a more even gooier pool on the dirt ground.
Why?
The gunshot hole in McElroy's face was so wide and clean, you could make out the pattern on the seat cushion through it. As patrolmen began identifying and interviewing potential witnesses, a common theme emerged. Don Palumbo, can you guess what that theme might be?
Nobody saw shit.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You nailed it.
Yeah.
Now, they wanted to make it clearly known that vigilantism would not be tolerated. Now,
then do your job. then do your job. And I am. We don't need vigilante justice. That is not. That's unexcusable as well, because then it becomes a lawless land.
Right.
But if it comes to this point where for decades, this guy can continue to rape your daughters and take them as his own, something has to be done.
Yeah.
And I can't believe I just said that out loud, but like, this is,
it feels weird to have to say that.
Yeah. What else? What was the other option?
They tried the other options. They tried every option.
Like,
and now the same system that had failed these people time and again was going to investigate and attempt to prosecute them.
Frick them for making me feel this way, man. I don't like that.
Woo.
I don't like that at all.
Trina quickly claimed to identify the killer, a man by the name of Del Clement. She said that she saw him fire two shots with a rifle from behind the truck.
Oh, you didn't see shit either, Trina. Come on. Like...
A task force of state cops and officers from other cities investigated the murder. Del Clement was the first man questioned. He said, quote, "Boys, I wish I could say that I'd done it, because he sure had it coming, but I didn't. He stole our livestock, shot our horses, raped our women." Now, sidebar, is it weird to anyone else that "raped our women" was the last transgression mentioned? But that's his actual quote.
But
so,
No, I don't think you're overthinking it, because in the way he said it, "raped our women" as if the women were their property. That is what they are put up against. It's our livestock, shot our horses, raped our women. The third list in priority as far as their property goes.
Yeah.
Ugh. But whatever.
Yep. Headlines blazed across the nation. Farmer killed in vigilante attack.
Farmer of what?
Teenage girls.
Oh. Thank you. I heard that coming from a mile away.
I didn't mean to. But
I knew that was going to happen. Ugh.
News outlets portrayed McElroy initially, news outlets portrayed McElroy as a farmer who was unsanctimoniously killed by vigilantes. Now, reporters from every major news outlet you can think of descended on Skidmore, Rolling Stone, People, Time, Playboy. They were all there. CNN, like it.
And hey, look, you guys, there are some good articles in Playboy, okay?
Well, yeah.
There really are.
Yeah. Because of McElroy's history, Skidmore thought they were going to have some sort of moral high ground in the story, but the media made it out as evil versus evil. According to some, these folks were now no better than their victim. Lois Bowenkamp was quoted as saying, quote, "The Bible says there should be an eye for an eye. Those who live by the sword die by the sword. Ken McElroy lived by the gun, and that's the way he died.
You always give them a Southern accent.
Well, it's Missouri.
I know.
It's Missouri. A 10-day investigation by the task force produced nothing. Even though 50-plus people were on the street that day when he was shot, not a single witness saw anything in broad daylight before lunchtime, and no one was lit. So one day before the official investigation was about to be called off, the FBI swooped in to take over, thanks to Richard McFadden, who sent him a letter and said, "My poor guy got killed."
Well, his cash cow died.
Yeah.
Like,
even in the face of FBI scrutiny, the people of Skidmore held together in their willful ignorance of the incident, which is what townspeople would forever call the McElroy killing, the incident. People openly accepted the killing and openly refused to cooperate or call it murder, and openly admitted McElroy had it coming. Someone even sold t-shirts that said on the front, quote, "Who shot KR?" And on on the back it said, "Who cares?"
Okay. The shirt that I had that said, when I was a child, that said, "Who shot JR?" I know definitely did not say "Who cares?" on the back, because everybody freaking cared. So that's right. A pretty good shirt, actually.
I would have bought one, maybe. So, and authorities were insulted. Get this. They were insulted at Skidmore's lack of help, and they wanted it known that vigilante justice, Don, would get this, not be tolerated. On Thursday, August 20th, the grand jury for the murder investigation of Ken McElroy began. Over the next 3 weeks, the jury heard from 45 witnesses. Although Trina identified Del Clement as the killer, no one stepped forward to back that up. Ballistics even matched her placement of Del as to the positioning of one of the killers, but it wasn't enough. On September 25th, the grand jury filed no charges. And with that, media outlets throughout the region destroyed Skidmore. I'm just going to share one quote, partial, from the Maryville Forum. Quote, "Citizens who take the law into their own hands are to be dreaded much more than the McElroys of the world."
Oh, that is a bold statement, Maryville. Whew. That is a very bold statement.
I don't know if history agrees with you, Maryville
right,
Forum.
That did not age well at all. Yeah.
Starting in August of 1981, hog and cattle theft in the region declined at a staggering rate. So too did barn fires. Coincidence, I'm sure.
Total coincidence.
In April of 1982, just when Skidmore thought the saga might be over, the FBI returned with a 15-man task force, leaning heavily on everyone known to have been on Main Street during the incidents.
Okay, and I'm annoyed by that, but only because we see the full picture. Obviously, if that were our person and, you know, justice was the other way, we would want that. So, yes, we can be annoyed because we can see the whole picture.
Well, and agreed. And they managed to produce four wishy-washy witnesses plus Trina. A federal grand jury was called, and the FBI pushed for murder charges to be filed against Del Clement. In November, the grand jury declared that substantial new evidence was not found and no charges would be forthcoming. The case would remain open for investigation. In major public interviews, Trina told anyone who'd listen that McElroy was the best guy ever, that he never raped her, especially when she had his kid at age 15 and he was like 35.
Oh, that hurts my heart so much.
Alice would also go on to defend McElroy as a good father to their kids and a wild man, but nothing like the villain Skidmore made him out to be.
Ugh.
Feels very Stockholm-ish.
Mm-hmm.
On July 9th, 1984, one day before the statutes would expire, Trina McElroy filed a civil lawsuit for wrongful death. Skidmore, Nottoway County, Steve Peter, Danny Estes, and Del Clement were named as defendants, and she was seeking more than $10 million in damages.
Oh, get fricked, lady. No. It was 1984. Like, that's $10 million. Here's a dollar.
I hadn't put it in here, and I know, like, we briefly mentioned it, but, like, the town felt sorry for her for a long time.
Yeah.
Until they didn't. And, you know, that point was probably about when she tried to fight Lois. So it's September of 85. Sure. That case was settled for the sum of $17,500. According to the most credible sources, 3 to 4 men knew of the continuance on the night prior to July 10th and decided they were going to do what must be done. Their preparation was premeditated. In the immediate aftermath, the rifle stocks were smashed to pieces, then burned, and then spread. The barrels were blowtorched into dozens and dozens of small fragments, then split up and dropped into the deepest wells on separate farms. While McElroy's corpse bloated and his blood congealed in the boiling hot sun, the weapons used to end his reign of terror were destroyed and disposed of before anybody even got there to see his rotting corpse.
They worked hard in that hour. That
yes.
A lot of work.
Although prevailing theories peg Del Clement, along with another local by the name of Gary Dowling, as the killers, the case remains unsolved and open to this very day. And now, Midwest Murder has officially told a cold case story. I guess maybe I should apologize because we always promise that justice is delivered for our victims. But I don't know.
We've had a few cases that justice has not been delivered. We have a few cases that remain that way, though. There's ambiguity. Like, the first one that pops in my mind is Eddie Peltier.
Sure.
You know, they don't.
Ambiguity, for sure. Yeah.
Yep.
But McElroy, yeah. His case right now, if someone stepped forward, they could prosecute this case. Del Clement passed away in 2009. There was no deathbed confession, and he always denied involvement with the murder.
Wow.
The case is still open to be prosecuted right now. Now, just a quick question, Dawn. Did a failed justice system transform these people into killers? And was their vigilantism justified? Just this one.
The failed justice system absolutely transformed those people into killers. Absolutely, they did. And that's what I said earlier, that the blood and the aftermath, the sexual abuse victims, all of these child victims, all of that that came after when he, you know, got out of his, what, 300th felony?
Yeah.
That is on the state. That is on everybody that just decided to turn the other way.
I agree.
I don't think I can openly say if it was justified, because that's, in this instance, someone had to do something.
Yep. I agree. Sources for this episode really came down to just two. In the book In Broad Daylight by Henry N. McLean, he actually spent years among the people of Skidmore to learn about this case, to study it. He was chased off of properties, bitten by dogs, punched in the face, had a gun pulled on him. These people, I cannot emphasize strongly enough how hard they fought to keep this secret over the years. And also henrymclean.com, the timeline from history.com, and goodhousekeeping.com. This episode was written by myself, Jonah Lanto, co-hosted by Don Palumbo and I. You can catch Midwest Murder Sunday nights at 9 on Beck. If you don't have cable TV, you can download the app. And
you can catch the podcast on every other Monday.
Absolutely. New podcast episodes every other Monday. Fargo, thank you. And
thank
seriously,
you,
like, fuck this guy, right?
Yeah,
like,
thank you. That was brutal.